Blog Talk Radio.
Hi there, this is Fran Lewis, and this is going to be a very, very different and very informative and exciting show. It's beautiful outside in Westchester. I can't believe the thunderstorms have finally stopped, which really makes it much easier to speak on the phone and not have to worry that we're going to get disconnected like last week, but we'll see what happens. Okay. The author of Tales of a Jailhouse Librarian is here, and this is really one of the most compelling books that I've read in a very, very, very long time. Mary Beth Seaman is here, and we're going to talk about what happens when she goes in and encourages young men in jail to want to read, and how she set up this amazing library to get these young kids that are in jail to read. So, hi, how are you?
Oh, I'm fine, Fran. How are you today?
Okay, just getting used to my new braces. So if anybody out there thinks I sound kind of weird, which I shouldn't, Invisalign, you can blame it on them. What can I say? So why did you decide to give up working in a regular school and come to work in a jail with these young kids?
Well, you know, I've explained in the beginning of the book, more or less, is that I really didn't make a conscious decision to work in a jail, per se. It was more or less that I made a decision not to work in the high school any longer because after 20-something years in a high school is they were actually consolidating my program and they were sending me to middle school. And I disliked the idea so much of going from teaching high school to teaching sixth graders that I knew that this program in the jail existed because my school district actually runs this program, and I had had some experience with teaching high-risk students in residential programs. One I volunteered in and one I had done a summer program, and I said, well, this seemed like a better transition than going to teach sixth grade. So that's actually how I ended up teaching in the jail program, that I told my school district there had been an opening, and I said that I would interview for the jail program. So it was not a conscious decision. I look at it today as a God-directed decision.
Yeah. Well, definitely for the boys that you come in contact with, it was the right decision. That I'm sure that they're all saying. So what was your
impression? Well, it was the right decision for me also, Fran. So, yeah. You know, I'm really thankful for that too.
That is just really good because there are not a lot of people that could do what you do. And not a lot of people that would have the stamina to do what you do, and to encourage these young kids to read. They have to read these stories. They're so compelling that a box of tissues. Forget it. It was so sad, some of them, and some of them were so gratifying that you know when they go, "Yo, Mrs. Z, I want a book to read." I mean, that's your whole world. You say, "Okay, great." When entering the jail for the first time and learning the rules and standards, how did that impact on you?
Well, you know, it wasn't that much, you know, out of the ordinary from working in a school. Is I think that I anticipated that there were going to be rules attached to going into a jail. And, it's in line with the fact that there has to be some safety and security in a jail. And so that seemed pretty logical. In terms of the implications where you have to adjust teaching and education, that did seem to impact what we were doing. The way that you conduct a classroom, the way that you group students, those are the kind of things that I really had to make an adjustment on. You know, something as simple as where, you know, you're going to place a new student in what classroom, you have to start thinking of things like, well, what gang is this student in as opposed to that student? And so can that student go into classroom 2 or does he have to go into classroom 3? Because this student's in the Crips and that student's in the Bloods. And, you know, you really can't do, per se, like cooperative learning because the jail personnel do not want the students to be passing what they call kites to one another, which are little notes. So, you know, it's like a throwback to 25 years ago when I first started to teach, where, you know, students are put in desks row by row, and the teacher is writing on the board. So, you know, that was more of an adjustment to those kinds of rules and regulations that the jail actually superimposes on the teachers when we're doing teaching or I'm going in and out of a classroom and interacting with the students.
How do they respond to the teachers? How do the boys respond to the teachers?
You know, I sometimes tell people when they say, oh, aren't you frightened to go into the jail? To be honest with you is these students are better behaved than the students that I really left behind in the high school.
I got that impression.
Yeah, I mean, they're very, very respectful. I am sure that where they're coming from, they were definitely not so respectful. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they have essentially hit bottom from where they're going, and they are essentially locked in all day. And if they don't behave in school, their other option is to be locked in a cell all day. So they all of a sudden have become extremely motivated to go to school. So they are so motivated to go to school, they are going to make sure that they are very well behaved. You know, up to the point that they do not want to engage in any fights. They do not want to be kicked out of the classroom.
Great.
I mean, in fact, you know, if they give the teacher any kind of guff, I mean, there's always two correctional offices in the hallway. And the teacher always has the option of just saying, oh, I'm not going to put up with this anymore. And, you know, calls the correctional officer and says, you know, this kid's giving me a hard time. So, in a way, I think from a teacher's perspective, it's probably easier than teaching in a regular, you know, high school.
You're probably right, because it's probably a lot safer. Because the kids are going to be, you know.
I mean, you know, everybody looks at it when I talk to them as this would be more difficult. I think probably, in a way, it's easier.
It sounds like
so, you know, that's what I really do not think that this is that, you know, that much of a difficult task in terms of classroom management. It's probably more difficult of a task in terms of teaching because the boys are academically challenged and very deficient in their educational background, extremely deficient. You know, they're coming to us with, I would say, third grade reading levels. Some of them are illiterate. So it's very challenging to try to teach such a diverse group of students because then you'll have students that are college-bound, and you have all of these students in the same classroom.
Do they make allowances? I know this is not on my paper. Do they make allowances for their differences? In other words, if you have children, students that are three that can't read or several that are in third grade, because I've done this before, and kids that are on a higher level, do they pair them up? Do they, you know, work with them differently? Does everybody get the same type of lesson from the teacher?
Well, that is what the difficulty is in terms of when you're asking me about the rules and regulations.
Yeah.
You know, I'm used to, prior to this, I was used to teaching ESL, and, you know, I did a lot of what they call differentiated instruction and cooperative learning in particular. And in this particular case, you really can't do that. Because they don't want really any interaction between the students. So the teacher really has to individualize lessons for every student in that classroom.
So what is she
doing? So there really isn't.
That's hard. That's not hard, but it's hard.
Yeah, it is. You know, they're going around and trying to get lessons for every kid in there. And, you know, you know, giving like a joint social studies, like a class discussion, and then giving, you know, material out that's on the level of the student.
That requires a lot of preparation on the part of the teacher. If they're dedicated, And it could really, you could do a lot. But the reading part of it is, of course, you want to give a challenging passages or challenging work to the kids that are higher. And you want to give, like, the sight word list and some, you know, beginning stuff to the other ones. And you can't work with them, like, even two together. You have to work with them one individually. In other words, if two students are reading on a pre-prima level, you can't work with them together?
No, not really.
That's hard. That's hard in the same classroom. So she actually has to walk over, sit with the person and say, okay, this is what you need to do.
Right.
These are the words for you. I mean, I could do it. I've done it. But it makes it harder. So what
Well, I mean, the only advantage is that I would say it's similar to a resource room, too, in as much as, you know, say you're going to have 8 to 10 students maximum in a classroom.
That's not too bad.
So you don't have a classroom of 25 kids.
You only have 10. So that's
right.
Not bad.
Right, and
I would say
possibly the largest group I've ever seen is 12. First of all, you know, from a physical standpoint, the classrooms are very small.
Mm.
So they're not going to accommodate more than 12 students. So, I mean, and I think they've been intentionally built that way. So, you know, you're not going to see more than 12 students. I'm sure that's from a security standpoint, too, although, you know, I never really asked anybody why the classrooms are so small, but I'm going to guess it has to do with some kind of visual security, so because you wouldn't be able to monitor more than that many people in one place. But,
yeah,
you know, I could be wrong.
Well, if you have 12 kids in a class that are, you know, the handicapped, you know, learning, just learning-wise, and you're giving a general lesson in social studies or science or math, then, of course, you can individualize with the seat work afterwards. It comes harder when you're doing the reading part of it. So which story would you like to share? I mean, Deshaun was so, oh, my God. And what happened with him?
I know that you have picked out his particular story. You know, and he's very relevant to anyone that lives in New York, to be honest with you, is because anyone that happened to live through Hurricane Sandy and was by it, you know, and it really you know, struck home with me because I live on Long Island. And when this kid did come in and I sat down to speak with him, because I'm, you know, essentially my, you know, being the school librarian is really my sidebar, you know, title. Is my official title is transitional counselor. And so I sit down and do all the intakes with the students. So when they come in, I sat down with this young man, Deshaun. And I started to talk to him, and, you know, I find out their basic information and their school background. And as I talked to him, it was a little bit around Thanksgiving, I guess. And it was the same year as Hurricane Sandy. Mm-hmm. And when I started to talk to him, what I discovered was that he was from Long Beach, Long Island. And my first question when I discovered that was, oh, wow, how did you do during the storm? And he essentially then said to me, well, they more or less lost their house. And I'm not sitting there with any notion that his arrest has anything to do with Hurricane Sandy.
Yeah.
You know, there's a disconnect on my part. I'm just, you know, making idle conversation with him. And I'm asking him then for, do you live with your mother? And he says, well, not really, that the family is temporarily displaced. His grandmother's living with people from church. His brother was sent down to Virginia. And now we start to engage in a conversation. And I'm beginning to realize the impact that this storm has had on this, you know, coastal community. And what I don't realize is that this community also has a curfew imposed on it.
Mm.
And that Deshaun has essentially been picked up for breaking curfew. And he has violated his probation, which, you know, probation is a means, essentially, with a lot of these kids. They're picked up on minor charges. And Deshaun had been picked up with his younger brother for trespassing. And he essentially got a youthful offender and probation, I guess about 6 months prior to that, for breaking into an abandoned house and throwing rocks at it, which seems like a minor kind of thing. But
yeah.
he got a probation, and you know what? You can't have even a minor offense when you're on probation. And Deshaun went out after 7 o'clock at night during this imposed curfew after Hurricane Sandy. So he was picked up by the police and hauled off to Mineola, put before a judge, and no one, he was met with a legal aid lawyer. He had no other adult present.
That's
and
scary.
So many of my students are minorities that can't afford a lawyer. And, you know, you go through arraignment court so quickly. Nobody seemed to bother to ask him, you know, what happened with your case. And they give him a felony. And they throw him in jail. And, you know, all of a sudden I'm asking him all of the particulars of his case, and I'm realizing that this young man is sitting in jail because of a hurricane. And that, you know, his lawyer is saying, well, don't worry about it. We're going to reduce the plea to a misdemeanor, and you're going to get out. But he's been sitting in jail for close to, I would say, 5 or 6 weeks, and the legal aid lawyer hasn't come back to see him.
They don't care. They don't care. They don't
and
care.
All this kid wants to do is be home by Christmas. So
oh,
I'm
God.
Saying, be patient. The legal aid lawyer will be back to see you. What he essentially did was he pled out to the e-felony, which,
oh, God.
You know what, e-felony is really nothing. Except for the fact that a felony stays on your record for the
record,
rest of your life.
That's bad
and
when you want to go to get a job, yeah.
Yeah, I just explained to a kid today is when, you know, you go out with the felony, I said for the rest of your life, somebody with an A felony, which would be for murder, for instance, and an E felony, which would be for trespassing, it's a felony is a felony. So when you fill out a job application when you're 49, and they say, have you ever been convicted of a felony?
You have to
answer yes. And I said, the person that's been in jail for murder answers the question yes also, and nobody's going to say, well, was it an E felony or was it an A felony? And in New York, you never can expunge a felony. So, you know, these kids that just plead out so that they can get out of jail. And, you know, albeit is, you know, is it may have been an error and the legal aid lawyer may have been working on, you know, changing the charge to a misdemeanor. It was taking a long time, and these kids don't have a lot of patience, and they understand that if you have an e-felony, it means you're going to do less time and you can get out quick, and that's all they're concerned about because jail's a horrible place to be sitting in.
They don't understand.
You know,
that's really so sad that the law doesn't provide anything for them and that the lawyers don't give them their basic rights. And who? And there's no way that he could get a different legal aid lawyer that he can't get somebody
else?
No.
No.
That's what's
and
really
a
crime.
I often say to them, you know, a legal aid lawyer is not a bad lawyer. They're busy lawyers. And, you know, I've done a lot of research for this book.
Yeah.
And what I've found is that the Legal Aid Society has actually filed some kind of a suit in Washington because they have so many cases that they themselves essentially have said that they do not have enough lawyers to handle all of the legal aid cases that they're assigned. So that there's been suits filed recently for people that are represented by legal aid lawyers, because they're saying that they're not getting fair representation in the courts, which is probably true. Because, you know, it's like a factory. They're going through and they're just assigning these lawyers that for, 2 months I have students that are sitting there and they're saying, could you please find out if I have a lawyer? The lawyer hasn't come to see me. And so they're sitting essentially 2 months in jail. And naively, when I started this job and knew only about education and nothing about the law, I was under the assumption you're innocent until proven guilty, and that, you would go to an arraignment court, you would be charged with something, and then you would go home until, you were called to a court case, like a Law and Order episode. The judge would, put the gavel down and, you're remanded on your own recognizance and, come back on July 7th or whatever. And instead, I have all of these boys that are just languishing in jail for months and months and months. That's why we can educate them. They never go home.
That is their home, unfortunately, and that is their life. And the only way they're going to get out is if they get some kind of power and education to understand. It's too bad they don't teach them the legal stuff in jail so they can actually learn to read the law and understand it themselves.
I mean, this has been an education for me. I'll tell you, Fran, I knew nothing about the law at all. And it really has been an education for me. And then when I was writing these stories, I decided that I would research some of the information, and also I've really made it my business when the boys complain and they say different things that are very stereotypical or make these broad general statements. I then go into researching on the computer and say, that can't be true, that, if they have a legal aid lawyer, they're going to be sent upstate. And, I did go and research this, and what I found was if you have a paid lawyer, you're more than likely to be given community service. And if you have a legal aid lawyer, you're more than likely. Yeah. The better news, at least, is that it's not as if one would go to trial and the other wouldn't. Is I did discover that 97% of all cases are plea bargains in the United States. And so naively, unlike my concept of law and order episodes, is that we essentially have no trials any longer
in the United
States.
That's what they want. They want them to plead. I read The Unvarnished Truth About the Prison Family's Journey, written by a prisoner that's in a Texas prison. So I got to read all of this stuff. And they said the one thing you never do is take a plea bargain. They said you would need
Amazing because none of these boys will, they all plea out. And, was funny because I found some research done by two lawyers, I think in North Carolina, and there's something called the prisoner's dilemma. And what they found was that even if you were innocent, you were more than likely to plead out to something rather than to jeopardize going to trial and taking a more severe punishment. So it's very interesting. It's more or less a psychological thing. So you and I, we could be sitting, in jail and could be absolutely innocent of a crime. And if they then, gave us the option, if you go to trial, You might get 15 years in jail, but if you plead out, we'll give you 5 years probation and time served. We'd be more than likely to say, okay, this sounds better than going to trial and going 15 years upstate.
It depends on the lawyer. Yeah, that's what these kids are, because they don't know better. They don't realize
right.
that they don't want to spend the money on the child, is what the other book said. It's the truth. And they would just rather have, okay, well, plead, blah, 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 because the district attorney feels like he won a case. And from what I gathered from reading it is that sometimes the lawyer will say, no, I'm not going to plea bargain. I want my client to get out. They change up. And the judge is happy because he doesn't have to be, you know, dealing with this. It's scary. So tell us about how do you get the books for your cart? And what type of books do these boys want when they you know, read? I donated my books. I just hope they like them, and I'll send more. I'm going to get more people to send
what?
If you tell me what.
Well, you know what? Your books, actually, I sent your books. You know, I shouldn't talk just about boys either. You know, the school does serve girls. And we have a very small girls section. But I'll tell you, we have one half of the teacher that does the girls, and it's a half-day program because mm-hmm. we have so few girls. And statistically, very honestly, mm-hmm. is it represents a female population mm-hmm. In prison because it's about half the population in prison in general are female. But in terms of where I get the books from is, you know, the school district itself gives us a small budget. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. most of our school budget goes on textbooks. So, you know, there is a certain allotment of money that's used on reading books. At the moment, because they revamped the entire GED. So New mm-hmm. York State now has a brand new test called the Task R. We are spending all of our money on buying all new test books for the Task R. So I'm not anticipating get a lot of new books. I put out, when I first started this cart to begin with, it was all donations. I kind of put a call out for mm-hmm. Books and through friends and, you know, it started out with a good friend of mine's son, Will Dennis, his name was an editor at DC Comics. So what seeded the beginnings of the book cart were all comic books and then whatever small imprints were DC Comics. And then I started to get other donations from different people. And more recently, I got involved with, it's a committee, an offshoot of somebody that writes the School Library Journal, and it's called In the Margins Book Award mm-hmm. Committee. And mm-hmm. so I've got involved with this, and they nominate the top 20 books for marginalized youth in custody and incarcerated teens. Now, this is not effortless. Is because mm-hmm. I'm reading an awful lot of books. That's my obligation. But publishers and via this committee are sending a lot of advanced reader's copies.
Well, that's great.
And I am reading. So you're reading a lot of adult books. I'm reading a lot of young adult books. But the plus side to that is that I'm getting a lot of nominated titles, and I'm getting to put them on the cart. And really what they want to do on this committee also is to get student feedback, which is great because the mm-hmm. boys really feel that they're engaged in the process, and they feel like big cheeses, if that's the right word, is they look and they can see it says advanced reader copy. They can see that the publication date may not be to the end of the year. And I'll say to them, you're part of the review process. And honestly, they really feel very involved in the process. And, you know, they volunteer to read these books and bring them back to me the next day and pass them around the dorm and tell me whether it was they thought it was a good read, if they don't think it, you know, should go to the female side. It's very interesting, the feedback I get from that.
Do they ever write little reviews on their books? Would they ever write them? You know,
I would publish
them in my magazine.
Well, this is something I was thinking of doing, is like making a starred chart on the cart of the books, because, you know, there's a certain level of, in terms of anonymity that would have to be involved in, in using names, because this is another aspect. It is, you know, it's very interesting. You have to think through everything. I can't allow one student to know the name of another student in another room or know the location of another student because, say, there's a blood in another room.
Gotcha.
And say, like, via the gangs, they're looking for, you know, another. It's very interesting. I just had a student last week that was actually moved from Rikers to our jail for protective custody. So I usually request transcripts from their home district. And I told the person, the secretary, in requesting the transcript, I said, listen, if it's not, like, really easy to get this kid's transcript, I said, do not pursue it. Because, you know, the more people that would be involved with getting the transcript, even a secretary or, you know, a student aide in an office.
They would know that's
I
not good.
I didn't know how much we were jeopardizing the student security. So you really have to think through, you know, what
that's
you're doing.
Gary.
You know,
really
so I was thinking just of having like a star review on the cart. I was trying to think this through, how I could do it. And that's what I was thinking of doing, just giving them like index cards and like, you know, I mean, smiley faces would be a little bit, you know, on the immature, but doing stars so that they could like color in stars. So it could be a 5-star review, a 4-star review, and something along that line. And, you know, we even give them lines so that they could use an adjective or whatever, and then it would remain nameless. I had thought about doing that.
That's sad that they can't even get credit for what they can do. It's really sad that they can't even be recognized. I know when I interviewed the author of the book, I couldn't interview the prisoner. They wouldn't let him on the show. And that was really sad because his story was more interesting than the rest of the story as to what happened. And some of what you wrote was exactly what they tell in the adult prisons, that in order for boys or prisoners to have the use of the phone or other amenities, they have to pay. That they're just simple hygiene stuff is not provided unless there's some kind of trust or something that they get that they pay for, and it's scary. The prisons make money and get money for every person that's locked up. Do they really? I mean, this is going to seem like a very unusual question, but I don't know. I often think that they really just want the kids to come back because it's money. I don't know how well they really feel, how happy they are when a young boy leaves and never wants to come back because they don't want to get locked up again.
You know, I've heard people say that, you know, particularly when it comes to upstate prisons, that there's a whole economy that is attached to it. You know, I don't really know that. It is, I will tell you from what I've been reading, because I'm so up and involved on, you know, articles and whatever. At this point, mass incarceration is such a hot topic, and it seems to be such a, it's a bipartisan topic, actually, because it's such a drain on the taxpayer. That I don't even know if really that, you know, that's a true statement anymore because it's a drain on the incarcerated's family and children is a drain on the welfare system. Is actually, even in upstate prisons where, like, these little communities, it's like generations of people that are employed by these prisons in the middle of nowhere. That the overcrowding of prisons are safety issues. is, you know, they can't just open the doors of the prisons and thin out the prison population and just let them go.
You can't. That's true.
And so, you know, even if they, you know, continued to employ the same number of people, that, what do you call it, there are too many prisoners. So, you know, in terms of, you know, the recidivism rate and wanting the people to come back, that may be, you know, true in the past. I don't know if, you know, is it's just like an oversaturation, if that makes any sense.
I
really do believe that there's a total shift in attitude and direction. Now, whether or not when it gets to a certain number, because, you know, very honestly, is that upstate communities in particular are very dependent on some of these facilities that have been built in the middle of nowhere. So, you know, I don't know necessarily about that, but I do know that, like, politically, that you, believe it or not, you could go on Newt Gingrich's website as well as Eric Holder.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and, you know, this is two polarities politically, and they both have similar statements and viewpoints when it comes to forms in incarceration, interestingly enough.
It's really, it's sad that the only solution to some of these kids is jail. I often wonder if there's some other way to make a point and to get them, you know, rather than locking them away. And what happened with Deshaun, it's really sad because he basically doesn't belong there. I mean, I know he broke a curfew, but
I'll tell
he doesn't
you the
belong
truth.
There.
So few of them belong there.
That's
exactly
the point.
I've said there are very few lessons to be learned in locking these boys up, is that clearly, you know, education and training are really what they need. Is they don't need to be locked up. Very few of them are there for major offenses. Most of them are there for minor offenses. A lot of them, the offenses are all attached to either drug or alcohol-related offenses, which need to be treated, and being locked up is not treating those kind of problems. And, you know, a lot of this has to do with, obviously, a lack of education leads to lack of, you know, employment opportunities, lack of academic advancement, which, you know, are all attached to their lives. And so, you know, their lives are going nowhere. And so, you know, they're resorting to petty crime in order to survive. And so they, you know, it's this cycle of crime that they're involved in. And when I'm saying crime, I don't even know if, well, it's crime because they're, you know, breaking laws. And really what they need to do, though, as a solution, is that when they get into the court system, the court needs to look at these kids when they're 16 and 17 and 18 and then, you know, look at their educational background and say, this kid needs to get reconnected into some kind of educational program.
Yep.
They don't need to be hauled off and put in jail. And, you know, interestingly, in the court system, there is no connection whatsoever to any kind of educational system. So, I mean, you know, I made a point of saying this in the book, is that when a lawyer meets, you know, a young man in court, the lawyer is not given any information about this, you know, young man's education, IEP, individual educational plan,
gotcha.
Has no idea what the student's IQ is, learning disability, emotional background. The only thing the lawyer has to go on is how this young man presents himself. So I have had students with, you know, below 70 IQs with like multiple page IEPs when I do send to their home districts. But, you know, they present fairly normal because, you know, a lawyer is not having a lot of interaction with them. You know, it's 5 minutes, you know, he meets them in arraignment court. And I said, the student comes in, he has his pants hung low, he kind of grunts, yeah, no, he has his hung, you know, his head hung down, and, you know, he's mimicking another street kid. So the lawyer says, well, he's just like, you know, like every other punk I meet in here. And, you know, he never questions. And, you know, most legal aid lawyers are very young. They have no educational background. And you know what? If you're a seasoned educator like you are, or I have a lot of experience in education, it almost becomes instinctual that you can meet a student and you almost know when they have special needs.
Yep, you do.
I don't
expect a lawyer
to know that.
But a little bit of compassion, a little common sense, and, you know, you see it on television. They meet with them. It's either they don't care or they don't know what to ask or they just want to get it done.
Yeah, and they lack the educational experience.
Yeah, they don't.
They've been trained to be a legal expert.
I'm not a legal expert.
They don't know. I really don't fault them because they're not trained and they're not provided the information that they need to know. So they don't have the knowledge and they don't have the information. And, you know, it's a matter of the time they have to spend, and they have a zillion cases. So this kid is then, you know, brought through an arraignment court, put in cuffs, and transported over to the jail. Now, I have the luxury of time is when the student is brought up to me and I sit down and I have a conversation with them and then I start to say to them, where did you go to school? And, you know, were you, you know, in resource room? And then, you know, when they don't respond and I say, well, were you given extra time on tests? Did you go see a special teacher? And now when a student says to me, oh, I was in a school and they were, you know, training me to, you know, push a broom or do something like that. You know, instinctively you say, well, I know that this student was in some kind of special program. And, you know, you start to say, well, what's the name of the school? Now, a lawyer is not having the luxury of having a conversation like that.
I know. Now, there's no work release. There's no anything in the prisons, I mean, in the jail. Once they're they want to read, they want these books, they want to, you know, get in touch with education. I mean, I think the saddest story was Derek because he missed out on the GED. He just got sent up, and that was really sad because he was looking to take it. What bothered me was that he's so close, then why didn't they let him take it wherever he went? Why did he have to wait? Why couldn't they just give him a chance so that he would make something? It's almost as if they're sort of like leading them to failure. And these kids in that you're working with have to know that there is a better world out there. They just have to, you know, unfortunately hang in tough to be able to get there. You said a certificate of good conduct, a certificate of relief, that you was discussed in there, and you also talk about Mary Robinson and why she came to the jail and how she what impact she had on the boys.
Yeah, is the certificate of relief and the certificate of good conduct.
Yeah.
A lot of people confuse that with having your felony expunged, and I said earlier.
No.
In New York, unfortunately, you never can have your felony expunged, which I really think is so unfair. Other states, Massachusetts for one, New Jersey also, after a certain amount of time, 10 years and 15 years, I believe, you can expunge a felony in those two states, which does seem so much more logical, is that, you know, if you're 18 years old and you commit a crime that, you know, when you're 28 or 35, that and you've led a decent life, that, you know, this will be gone off your record and you can move forward. And many, many people, including some correctional offices that I work with, will say to the kid, oh, well, when you get out of here, apply for a certificate of relief, and will, you know, try to be helpful and say to me, explain to them how to apply for this. And I'll have to point out to them that both of those things are things that, you know, ex-felons can apply for. Essentially what they are pieces of paper that will say, demonstrate that you are trying to live a good life and you haven't reoffended, and that the state is issuing you a piece of paper so that you can move forward and apply for a license. In the instance of a certificate of relief, believe it or not, it allows you to run for public office.
Really?
And for a certificate of good conduct, you can never run for public office. And the difference between the two is that a certificate of relief is issued once you leave a correctional facility, and you get a temporary one. And then after you've served probation, you get the certificate of relief, and you're you either have to have a misdemeanor or only one felony. And if you have more than one felony, and it's like, you know, a C, D, and E felony, after 3 years, and that's how long you have to wait. That's a long time. After 3 years, you can apply for that certificate of good conduct. If you have an A or B felony, you have to wait 5 years. And you have to wait till you're off parole before you can even apply for it.
Mm-hmm.
So you could be waiting as long as 7 years just to get that piece of paper. And all that piece of paper says is that, well, you've been giving it a good try. So, I mean, it's better than nothing, but I often say to my coworkers, you know, in today's economy, you know, it's only as good as the piece of paper. I mean, it's better than nothing, but, you know, in any case, it's better to be able to have the felony expunged, and they really don't give ex-felons that opportunity. So they're limiting people that have been in jail's lives forever.
I'm going to ask you one question while I'm going to take a two-second break, but I'm going to let you, I want you to answer it for our listeners. What do you hope that readers come away with after reading this book?
Well, one of the things that I hope that they come away with is that they understand that education is really the only means of these boys escaping the cycle of incarceration that they will fall into if we don't offer them that opportunity, and that if at this stage of their lives we only have a small window of opportunity left to do that. And that's really what I think the purpose of the whole book is that, you know, I'm trying to really emphasize that these are young men that we only have a small amount of time left to really rescue them before they fall into a pit, is because the cycle of incarceration, recidivism rates are as high as almost 46%. So that people reoffend and reoffend and reoffend. And, you know, you really want to see these young men escape that. And we do have that opportunity.
How many of them come back, and how many of them actually leave and never come back?
Well, you know what? That's what I said the frustration of my job is.
Yeah.
It's the not knowing. I don't know. You know what? There is no longitudinal study. There's no way of tracking them. You know, they leave. They don't go into a specific program. If they're sentenced upstate for 2 years, they leave from upstate, and they go off, and that is one of the greatest frustrations I have.
Yeah,
you know, when I was teaching ESL, I'm still connected with students on Facebook. You know, I connect and I see a student upstate in Albany that took me out to lunch. It's so satisfying and rewarding to connect with old students.
Yep, I know.
These students go out and, you know, I make a joke with them. When they leave, I say, good luck. And I said, and I don't want to see you back here again. I said, the next time I see you, I want to see you online in CVS. And they kind of look at me, and then they get the joke. It is like, you know, I want to see you out in the real world. And, you know, maybe we'll encounter each other online in the drugstore, and that's where I want to see you. And so, you know, and that's the truth. I don't want to see them back in jail.
I don't blame you. But before we go, because I'm not sure when the other author is going to get here, and if I'm going to, I don't know. Where can people donate books? You're going to put the information on Facebook wall, right? So that anybody wants to donate books to the prison, they'll know where to send them, and then I can lead them in the right direction.
Yes, you know, I'm going to put my address on the Facebook wall, and it would be to my attention, and I'm going to give you my director's name, because it's actually Veer, the assistant principal at the high school, because to mail it directly to the jail, it goes down to the mail room, and it will take weeks before it gets to me. So, and in particular, I'm looking for young adult books geared towards African American and Latino books, but I'm going to put a call out there for, we are desperate for Spanish language books. Wherein I have, you know, some English books, I have a whole bunch of Spanish speakers that do not speak any English, and I have no books to give them. And some of them barely read and write Spanish, and wherein I'm an ex-ESL teacher, I understand that I need to improve their Spanish literacy skills in order to transfer over to even attempt to teach them English. So I
do ever get in touch with Schoolwide Inc. Schoolwide Inc. is run by a young guy named Jess Cohn. He's a multimillionaire. He's not even 40, and he deals with Scholastic books and all these books that they bring to the school. The reading is fundamental and stuff like that. I would connect with him and tell. I would connect with him and tell him I told you so. I told you to. His sister is a reading specialist also, Robin, and maybe Jess could do something, you know, for you guys too.
Oh, really? All right. I'm going to email you specifically for his name, because I'm telling you, I'm desperate for Spanish books, and I've actually approached the library system and Nassau County, and they do not have a lot of Spanish books. So you know, they were sending me Gabriela Garcia Marquez, who's a wonderful writer, but not on the level that these kids are. You know, so I have a friend who's a bilingual teacher in Corona in New York City, and she was actually sending me some books, but like, you know, children's kind of books, and I didn't need like third grade books either, is these are, you know, young men, like, you know, 16, 17, 18.
Yeah.
So it was kind of difficult. I mean, these guys, believe it or not, that are the Spanish speakers, they were reading The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe and loved it.
Oh, I love that book. I love that book.
Yeah, and they were reading Harry Potter. That's what I said. It's such a paradox that you have gang members that are reading Harry Potter and The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
I'm going to go to my library over here, to the Greenberg Library when I go, and I'm going to ask them. Let me just greet the other author she just got on here.
Oh.
Janet, hi. I'll be with you in just a second. Well,
okay.
I'm glad you're here. I'm going to go to the Greenberg Library because my husband goes there all the time. Me, you know, people send me books. I don't buy them. But they have a section for where they sell books for a dollar. you know, all sorts of books and everywhere. So I'm going to go there and see if there's anything that would fit with what you want for young Latinos, African Americans. And maybe they would, if I tell them and show them the information and explain the program, maybe they would actually help out and send some books. You never know.
Oh, well, I would really appreciate that, Fran, because as I said, is, you know, it's just amazing to me, you know, what is in doing this and establishing this school library cot, they're so motivated to read, and some of the things that they're enthused about reading, it amazes me. It really touches me that, you know, you have these young men that are supposed to be such hardened individuals, and, you know, they gravitate towards, you know, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is, you know, by C.S. Lewis. And, you know, and it's such a metaphor for other things that, you can see through what, you know, what they've become and understand that at heart that they're really other individuals, and that, you know, if you penetrate through that other layer, that, you know, they're impressionable young men and that you can still reach them based on what they're reading and what they like. And I think that that's what really inspires me to, you know, provide them with reading material, because I get the feedback and I see the insight that they get, and I understand how powerful reading is in influencing towards new ideas and new insights. And I believe you can still penetrate that, you know, whatever, you know, influences they've had up until now, I really do think that I can still influence that and shift their attitudes and thinking.
I definitely think you can, and I definitely think you're going to continue to do that for a lot longer. But I'm going to put this out on my review sites. I have like 5 of them. And I'm going to put it out on my Facebook wall. And when you send me the information, I'm going to ask people if they're interested in donating and how this could help these young men, you know, because we need to turn them around, and this is too important. But I want to thank you so very much for doing this today. And
well, thank you very much for having me. And it was very enjoyable having a conversation with you and our little side conversation beforehand.
Thank you so much. And if you're writing more stories or you want to give me an update on what's happening, I'll let everybody know also. But this is amazing. And tell those boys to hang in there and tell Deshaun don't give up.
Oh, I will. Thank you so much, Fran.
You're welcome. Bye.
Okay. You take care. Okay.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Janet, hi.
Hi. I'm not listening.
That was very, very interesting. She works in a jail with young boys that are,
yeah,
and then she does an amazing, amazing job. They want to read, and I donated my books. I donated 11 titles to the prison, and I'm going to put out an all call for anybody that has books for young Latinos, African Americans, and anything that's written in Spanish, so that they can send them, you know, directly to her, so that we could donate some more books. But I do have the address of the assistant principal. But your book was different.
I know.
Before I forget, everybody, next week I'm taking the week off because I'm getting new braces, the second set, and I figure, you know, I need to give myself a chance to get used to them, because the week after I have a double show. Okay, for you guys, people out there that want to listen to something really wild, it's going to be June 18th at 4 o'clock. Hot male authors with sizzling hot male lead characters, seriously, and hot, really evil villains. And on that show, we're going to have, it's going to be a riot. From England, my favorite author, number one author in England, Roger Ellery, will be here. The author of First Blood and Rambo and Murder as a Fine Art, David Morrell, will be there. My favorite forensic psychiatrist, whose characters are all evil, and whose new book, Mad Dog Justice, is coming out September 1st, and he's going to come on the show again in September, Mark Rubenstein, We have Dennis Carstairs, Desperate Justice, and it's Mark Cadella is great. And my good friend, and he's a friend with my uncle, but he's a New York Times bestselling author, Alan Topol is going to be on the show. We're going to talk about Craig Page. So that should be fun. And then the next day we're going to do Alan, the Argentine Triangle, and find out more about the mean general and what happens when Craig Page gets sideswiped by the government. But right now we're going to do a little romance. We're going to talk. I'm reading a romance book, and at least your book has romance in it. And the romance book I'm reading is basically filled with historical events. It should have probably been written, intellectual pursuits lead to romance, but what can I say? So it's called Flirting with Disaster, and Janet Kleinman is here. And Janet, tell everyone about, summarize your book. Give them an idea. So they're going to want to read this.
Well, the book is a story of a lonely widow called Gloria, who's looking for love and meaning in her life, and she's suddenly startled one day by a phone call from Mickey Green, an ex-jock and a boyfriend who is now a gambler living in Mississippi. And it sets off a series of nostalgic emails from someone she hasn't seen for 40 years. But at the same time, she's not just doing emails. She's also teaching Haitians better English. And one of the Haitians is Henri Bettencourt, who's an ex-banker in Haiti, and he's an exile, and he's a great student, but he's also tall, handsome, determined to bring democracy to his country. And they become infatuated with each other. Well, Mickey invites her to Biloxi to a party for his niece that is being hosted by his brother, Dr. Philip Bettencourt. And after the banquet, they drive down to the beach and grow closer, and the romance escalates. And at the same time, Gloria attends a rally for presidential candidate Barack Obama. And then she sees Mickey, and before she can reach him, he disappears but shows up later on her doorstep. Somehow she lets him in, and they consummate something that should have been left unfinished 40 years ago. But she grows confused. And, of course, Mickey is a gambler, which she didn't even know. And he says goodnight, and he goes off to a poker game. At the same time, she's seeing this gorgeous Haitian, who is romantic, who's a widower, who's educated, and they have dinner, and she helps send supplies to Haiti for him. But in the middle of all this, a terrible thing happens. There's an earthquake in Haiti, and the devastating earthquake makes Haiti a tragedy. Homeless children are running all over the streets. Henri returns to Haiti and asks her through his cousin, Dr. Bettencourt, to come to Haiti and to help organize a school in the midst of all this chaos for those children who are running wild all over the street. She thinks about it and decides, God, I'm over 50. Life's a little bit boring. I think I'm going to do this. I like Henri, and I think maybe I can do some good. And she goes off to Haiti, and of course, nothing always stays platonic, and she and Henri have their own affair, but at the same time, she is setting up schools for the children on a hillside going down to the water in a city called Jacmel, which is just a suburb of Port-au-Prince. And the school is very successful. The children love her. She gets the older boys who know a little English from being on the seaport to help her with signs. And everything's going well when all of a sudden, out of the clear blue sky, Mickey shows up with a band of guys from Mississippi, and on the excuse that they've come to build houses. Well, things get a little confusing. Henri is there. Mickey is there. Both of them think she's lovely, and none of them are young, by the way. They're all people. Henri's a little younger, but the others are in their 50s and 60s, but they're still romantic. They still, the hormones that drive young people also drive them. And so she's confused, and then one day she finds out that Henri, when she wasn't in Haiti, had an affair with a brown-skinned beauty who is very, very young. And when she confronts him about it, he says, in Haiti, that's all right. We'll support the child. It doesn't matter if there's one more. It's not a sin in Haiti. However, she doesn't really accept that. And she doesn't know why Mickey is also building houses for the poor. Mm. She likes the idea, but hasn't found out why. And before she can find out, she contracts malaria and is brought to the health station by the French nurse who's her friend. And who is taking care of her but the young native girl with a protruding belly that was basically Henri's paramour. Anyway, she eventually gets over the malaria and finds out that Haiti, they're rebuilding this hotel, but they're going to bring gambling back to Haiti. And actually, Henri's family owns the hotel. And she can't believe that the two men who are right now in her love life and et cetera are plotting, have the same greed and the same ambitions as men all over the world. And they're not just doing it because they like the people. They're not just doing it because they want Haiti to recover from the earthquake. They're doing it because they want to make a lot of money. And but that doesn't go quite that easily because the U.S. government sends in a retired senator to see what they're doing with the money that the government is sending. And he's very impressed with what he sees, to be very honest. And the Tri-Poets 10th Schoolhouse and so on. And he invites Nikki and Gloria to Washington to testify at a hearing on Capitol Hill. And Gloria wants to know more about him. In the meanwhile, Lucia gets raped when she stops to watch a cockfight. Gloria finds her bleeding and rushes her to the hospital, and she delivers a stillborn baby. Lucia dies, and Henri blames himself for her death. In the meanwhile, he's won an election, and but she is disgusted, and her relationship with both her Haitian lover disintegrates, as does her affair with Nikki, who tells her that he and the Henri are really partners. Henri's family own the land on which he is renovating the hotel, and he thinks it's great that he's going to bring gambling back to Haiti. Anyway, when Henri wins the election, there is a big, big inauguration on the grounds of the National Palace, and the Archbishop of Haiti is swearing in the new president, which is Henri. Gloria is sitting with the ambassador from Washington watching it when a shot rings out, and Henri is killed. He's not killed at that point. He is shot. Mm. And she sees a man run away screaming that he's glad he killed him because he made his child die, referring to Lucia, who once had the baby and died. She's driven to the hospital. Carter goes with her to the hospital after he has gotten to, they've gotten to know each other when she was in Washington at the hearing, comforts her, and she realizes this older man comforts her and he makes her feel safe. And that's what she needs right now in her life. And from that point, she goes back to Florida, sells her apartment, and is invited to move to D.C., where she and Lance Carter, believe it or not, plan a wedding. And do I give them the ending or do I don't?
No, you don't give them the end. You don't give them the ending.
Okay,
we're not going to
tell you how it ends.
No, because obviously from all of there, you could definitely say that you can bring the story back again because basically, well, Henri, he's gone, but Mickey is still around. And it would
well, Mickey
really,
is at the hearing in Washington.
Yeah,
and
he's
he
still there.
He tells him what happened, but she doesn't want him anymore.
Well, what would happen if he didn't give up on, you know, he's married also, right? And he's got a wife.
That's right.
She didn't know that.
And she didn't know that in the beginning. Well, she knew he was married, but he said he was in the process of getting a divorce, which he never was.
They all say that. Yeah, they all say that.
So she's had a fling, frankly, that a lot of middle-aged women need, an excitement in their life. And it changes a very ordinary life for her, although it looks like it goes towards a very ordinary but high-class ending. So
that's up to Gloria, except if the author decides to bring in a fourth guy, but you never know.
No, I don't think this author is going to bring the fourth guy.
No,
three guys were enough.
Yeah,
you know?
She, I mean, yeah, she made the, and there was a couple of times in the book when I would say to her, Gloria, wake up, realize Mickey's not right, he's lying, blah, blah, blah. But she, it takes a while sometimes because you want to believe what you want to believe, and you don't see through the rest of it. And why did she think that her hormones, she started to think with her hormones, not her brain at sometimes. And it's amazing after 40 years, a lot of us do now.
A lot of us do that. It's none of us really know, you know, marriages that could be good and comfortable and so on. But I think that it's a universal thing to remember a first boyfriend. And in this case, he was her first boyfriend. And they were very young, and then he enlisted in the Navy and left. And she never saw him again. She heard about what happened to him because there was a chain of friends that kept in touch and high school reunions and so on. So she knew what happened to him, but she had never heard from him again, and it remained something that just happened at a time when the hormones of late teenagers were very, very active. So
well,
that part.
And she was glad to hear from him, and she sort of fell into his trap.
Yeah. I'm not so sure he started it as a trap. You think he started it out of nostalgia. I think all of us get a little nostalgic about people we went to school with, people we had a first date with, our first dance. I do get a little nostalgic about it. I'm the author, but maybe that's why. I wonder what happened to people.
Yeah, you do. You do wonder what happened. I mean, I'm had three very close friends when I was growing up, and I can't find them on Facebook or anything like that, but I only put my book reviews and talk about my author sites and stuff like that. But I guess if they found me or tagged me, I would really be, that would be great. I get tagged by my students, you know, students that I work with in reading and students that were in my school, and they'll say, oh, I'm an EMT, I'm a nurse, I'm this, and I get all excited. I go, I told you, I knew you turned out to be great. Or I walked into Bed Bath & Beyond 2 weeks ago, and the manager was one of my students, and she made this whole big fuss because I was there. I was like, okay, this is great. But, you wonder sometimes what happened to that very first boyfriend I had when I was six. And actually, he was just the boy in my class, and my mother let me go to the movies with him. And I always wonder what happened to Bruce. I don't know. And you wonder what happened to your very best friend when you went to elementary school also.
That's right.
So why did you hone in on Haiti? Why of all places?
Well, let me tell you, I wrote the book started with about the first boyfriend. In the first part of the book, I didn't know exactly where I was going. I'd written some other novels. One is in the drawer and one is being completed. And all of a sudden, there was an earthquake in Haiti, a devastating earthquake. And I was very moved. There are many Haitians living in this part of Florida. And they are working and they are achieving like other immigrants. And all of a sudden, their mothers and fathers and children were either killed under the rubble or orphaned. And suddenly the book changed. Since I knew these Haitians because I was tutoring them in English for the Literacy Council, some were smart, some were not so smart, didn't matter. I knew how they were feeling. And it suddenly gave me a reason to change the book and to make it meaningful. And that was my way of making it meaningful, the fact that I could write a book that showed that Haitians and Floridians and everybody could work together to try to help the country. But within that help comes the other universal factor of love. It can turn to love, and it can turn to just being a helper. So that's how that arrived. And I got going with it, and it kept going and going. I have saved every single headline about Haiti in, I have a folder as big as a volume. And so it really is the story. The Haitians I know and have read the book, they love it. They feel it's really the story of what happened in that time in the world. And it was a world thing. Yeah, so that it's still not finished. Right now they have, malaria is passed, and there is another disease that is rampant from a mosquito that is attacking Haiti. And it hasn't been rebuilt yet. you know, parts are, but not all of it. And I also made some wonderful friends through this. So there are friends who amaze me at how much they are trying to get the country rebuilt. One is the Albert Schweitzer Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
That's a plug that I don't know if I'm supposed to give, but
that's okay.
It is amazing. Yeah, it's a hospital, and it was started by in West Palm Beach, not for this, and it's the best hospital in Haiti, and it's an American hospital. So that's how that Haiti got into the story. But also, there were congressional investigations of what was happening to the money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's how Senator Carter is a made-up character. But there were investigations and people who were sent in to see what was happening to the money. And he
well,
and
you often wonder where these donations are going, and you often wonder if they're going to the people themselves or if they're going to the administrators also.
Yeah, well, that was his job.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
He's a retired senator, so he's not really on the take as much.
Oh, hold on one second. We have a caller. Hi, Marcia. Are you there? Hello? Hello?
I am.
Marcia?
I'm just listening. Yeah.
What? Are you there? I can't hear her.
I don't either.
I had to ask her to call in for 1 second so I could take a break because I've been doing this for 2 hours and I need to just do one thing, so I thought she would just, you know, talk for a couple minutes. Marcia, are you there? I can't hear her. I know she's on. I think something's with her phone. I don't know why.
Hello?
Hello?
Yeah,
hello?
Are you there?
Marcia? Yes, I am. I just,
yeah,
I couldn't
okay.
get in before. Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to give you a chance
you
to tell everybody. Yeah, I'm going to give you a chance to tell everybody about your shows on A Good Story is a Good Story, because I got to just hang, take a break for 2 seconds.
Okay, I'm here.
This is Janet. Janet is talking about her book, Flirting with Disaster, and let me tell you, you want to read this one. It's got a lot of romance. I'll be right back.
Hi. All right, I think
I'm
right. Hi. You probably know about the World of Ink, right? I think she probably wants me to talk about the World of Ink, all the hosts we have. Okay, and, well, I think you know Virginia, right? You know Virginia?
I don't know anyone there on your end.
Oh, you don't? Oh, you don't.
Oh.
Okay. World of Ink is Virginia Grenier and myself, and then we have the hosts, which are R.J. Jeffrey and Bennett Pomeranz, Fran Lewis, Willow Cross, Tracy Ford, Cassandra Dane. And they're all the hosts. And we have a new show coming up that is on Wednesday night, once a month, with Ashley Fontaine and Joanna Doster. This is kind of like a fun show, not about promoting books, because usually that's all we do is promote books. And so we're trying, you're right. So now we're just trying to have a little fun, because I think what happened to a lot of people is that they're over-marketing. And we're not having fun writing, which seems to be a problem out there.
Are you a writer too?
Yeah, I'm an author and a screenwriter and radio show host. Yep, I am. I've been doing this for like 20 years. Yes, I have children's books and other things. So you know, children's a romance book, but the marketing takes over for people. That's what I've heard. I get calls all the time about how much marketing.
Oh goodness gracious! Oh, my
it's
goodness.
We're talking about marketing. Right? I'm going to get off in a minute. We're talking about marketing, and I mentioned all the hosts and everything and how much people need to have more fun in marketing, because marketing is really time-consuming.
Yeah, it is.
But it's time-consuming. It's not as much fun as writing. And you think you finished writing the book, and you're done, but you're not. You first start working.
Right. Yeah. You're never done. I know. It's much easier to write.
I think so.
Okay,
but
I mean, Fran.
Yeah.
Fran, do you need me to stay on, or do you? I couldn't get on before, Fran, because something at work. My computer was not.
Yeah, I think
I
ate something. I think I ate something that was in Rottenville before. I have no idea why. What happened? But I should make it for another 15 minutes. I hope.
Okay. I'll listen in because it's your interview. I'll listen in if you need anything. Let me know. Okay.
I will. Thanks.
Okay. Right,
I definitely ate something that's not right. I have no idea what.
Well, we won't tell the audience.
No, we won't tell them. I don't know what it was,
okay.
Whatever. I didn't eat much today. I really don't. Since I've gotten these braces, I actually don't eat very much of anything. And I said,
I'm not
going to
ask you how old you are.
No, I'm not that old, but my dentist thinks I'm young enough for Invisalign. That's all that really matters. It's
okay,
hilarious.
Good. I'll listen. Some of us have implants because we don't want to have anything else. So.
No, you don't want to do these. Trust me, you don't want to do them. No.
Yeah.
They're annoying and they're whatever, but it keeps me young. What can I say?
I've gotten quite a bit of publicity. This is the third radio show I've been on, and I'm delighted. And I'm speaking around the area. In fact, I have my last speech for the season will be Sunday morning at the Valencia Shores, which is a country club, at the breakfast. So I'm looking forward to that. But I was very much looking forward to getting on a radio show that's in New York. And
That's not so easy.
I know. When I saw WOK in Ardsley, I thought that was wonderful. It's as close to New York as I could get.
Oh, that's all right.
And that was wonderful to me. And do you want to tell them where they can get my book, or shall I?
You tell them. But are you going to bring Gloria back in another book, or are you going to?
No, I'm not. I'm in another book.
Oh, okay, we're going to talk about that for a couple of minutes, too. But
okay.
For those people that think that just because you're on AARP that you're dead and buried, read this book, because they're definitely glorious, far from dead and buried, let me tell you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, for those people that are on AARP, what can I say? They really think, you know, that when you're a senior, really, I don't consider myself anything other than a teenager in life. That they forget that we've got, you know, most people have energy, spunk and whatever, and you walk into a room and they decide to talk to you as if you have no clue where life is going, which is not true. So what's next for you? What are you writing next?
I'm writing a book called Goodbye Russia, Hello America, and it's the story of a family who comes here in the 1920s and acclimates to life in America, but leaves one son behind in Europe. And all of a sudden, World War II breaks out, and one of them is drafted and promises his mother that if he gets to Europe, he will try to find Yehuda. And that's the promise he makes. He does get to Europe, but I'm not telling you what happened. That's interesting.
And what's the title of the book?
The tentative title is Goodbye, Russia, Hello, America.
Interesting.
So that's where that is. It's about two-thirds done, first draft anyway, and I promise I'll call you when it's all done. I promise.
I want to read it before it comes out so I can, you know, tell you what
do
I think.
Do you? Well, okay.
That's what I usually do. I do that. I read books before they come out and give people, critiques as to what they should do to improve it. They could either take my opinion or tell me not my opinion. I'm usually right, though. It's scary, but so where can we learn more about you, and where can we get this book, Flirting with Disaster? For those of you that think that just because you're over 40, forget about 50, 40, and, you know, you're not going to meet a guy, this lady met three. Ha-ha.
Ha-ha.
Uh-huh.
Well, you go into Amazon, you'll see some people who wrote in, and one of the things they wrote in after reading the book, it's about time somebody wrote a romance about people who are older.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was one of the things. But also, I also, because of the book, was awarded the Lifetime Achievement Award from Brooklyn College.
This
past September. Uh-huh. So that was a prize. I'm very proud of that. And the book can be gotten from Amazon, from Barnes & Noble, and I see there's some local booksellers will get it for you. I think it's worth reading about me if you go into Janet S. Kleinman's bio.
Mm-hmm.
You can read all about me. And there's quite a bit on Amazon about me, too. So that's all there. And anybody wants to hear more about me, they can get in touch with me by email. I don't know if that's something that people do, Fran.
Well, if they want your email address and they want to know more, I would rather have them ask me for it than give it out on the air, because we don't want everybody in the universe emailing you because you don't know who they are. And
right.
I screen
Thanks.
People, and I'm very funny. Okay, and if there's anybody out there, and I'll put it out on my review site, that would like to read the book, and review it. We'll see what we can do about getting you some more of my wacky reviewers on my review site.
I would appreciate that.
I've got some really, really good people. I've got a lot of good people that review books when they remind them that they're supposed to review the books of the people that ask for them to be reviewed on the site. Yeah. I've got 70 books. I got literally, I think I got 50 now. I lost count. I don't even know anymore at this point. That when I received your book, I said, okay, good, I'm going to do it right now. Otherwise, I'm not going to ever get to it. And, yeah, it's a good thing that I read it. And it's adorable. It's cute. Gloria's got spunk, and Andre is unique, and Mickey, you want to smack him in the head. And Lance is, well, we're not going to tell you who she winds up with, if anybody, because, you know, first boyfriends are first boyfriends, what can I say? Anyway, but I want to thank you so very much. And let me remind everybody that I am going to put on my Facebook, I put an invitation to anybody that wants to donate books to the jail for Mary Beth Zeman. If you want to know more about the prison, the jail program and the library program, and you have any books for YAs on Latinos, young Latinos, African Americans, if anybody has Harry Potter in Spanish, anybody has any Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe in Spanish, or any other books for young Spanish readers for older boys, please email me and let me know, or private message me on Facebook, and I'll tell you where you could send these to the jail. It would be greatly appreciated, because we want to keep these boys out. We want to prevent them from coming back to jail. And I want to thank you so very much, Janet, and please make sure that Fran gets the next one.
Oh, I will. There's no question about me. It might take a few months, but the next one will be ready. And I'm going to Fran first. Okay?
That's exactly the point. You come to me first, and then if you come to me before you write the book, I'll write you an endorsement on the back of your book so that people will want to read it. All you have to do is just send me the book before it's published, and I will write something, and then you could put it on the back cover and say, Fran said to read the book, and they'll read it. Don't worry about it. People read what I tell them to read.
I want to thank you. Are there any other questions you have for me about the book?
Yes, hold on a minute. Wait a minute. Would you call this a true adult romance or just a romance?
I would call it I don't hate to call it just an adult. It's an adult romance, but it's true, and it also has some fantasy in it. You know, years ago I read a book written by Mark Twain, and he wrote that if you write a book that is exactly like life, it's boring. If you exaggerate it and make it a little bit more, it becomes good reading. People don't want to read the same thing that's in the newspaper. They want to read something a little different. And so I try to do that without trying, you know, and let it come naturally. And this is the way I would have wanted it to spell out if I were reading. And so I call it a romance. It's a romance and an adventure that could happen. And
well, if you were Gloria in the book, you'd probably have a lot of fun, too.
Well, you know, when I was 20 years ago, my husband didn't want to travel. He was married to his business. And I went to Israel as a volunteer for 3 weeks. And I would have to say that if I counted the 5 most exciting things that happened in my life, the fifth would have been the trip to Israel alone at an army base. And in that way, I understood a little bit how Gloria felt.
Mm-hmm.
I did something wonderful. I only had to look for holes in tires. She had to take care of children.
Mm-hmm. Well,
So it was not so unlike things that have happened to me or to you. I don't, you know, as only exaggerated in a different setting, in a setting that was important to the world.
Well, bringing in Haiti was interesting. Making her an educator was interesting. I'm just wondering if Gloria would ever go back there because she loved working with the children rather than just giving it up. You'd have to ask her.
I don't. Well, I have to ask her. I have to ask me to ask her. Okay.
That's exactly right. But tell everybody where your website is and everything one more time before we go.
Tell them what? Excuse
me. Your website, where you find.
Website. I don't have a website. You can just go into the book and it'll all come up. Flirting with Disaster by Janet S. Kleinman will bring you up to the books and my bio, or go into the bio, or you can go into my blog, which is The Literary Life of Janet S. Kleinman.
That is very, very interesting. And I am looking forward to reading the next one. I think our connection is dying over here. I don't know why. I'm hearing like somebody washing something. I have no idea what's going on. Anyway, I want to thank you very, very much. And I would suggest that maybe you look into some women's groups to talk.
I have for the women's club. I have spoken for Hadassah. I'm a little limited because I'm in Florida, but there's a lot of places to talk here. I've spoken at the Delray Library, and it's beginning to bear fruit based on the numbers coming in.
So, you never know. Maybe even the senior housing places, senior citizen or housing places, they would like it because they're always looking, you know, the older people.
Something a little spicy, yeah.
Yeah,
they might. Exciting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I'll take your advice, but I can't reach the rest of the country unless I get to people like you.
Well,
this is an honor for me to be on the radio.
Thank you. Well, I could suggest that if you tag on Facebook, Delaney Oaks, she's got a show called Delaney's Tea Time. Tell her I told you to tag her. I'll tell her, too. She's got a really cute show also. She probably would like to talk to you and have you on there also.
What did you say, Delaney Oaks?
Delaney Oaks. She's on my other network on Red River Writers. As a matter of fact, what I'll do is I'll put you in an email with her, and I'm trying to think of another. If maybe even you know Virginia. Virginia has a show also, Writing Mamas. But you can ask.
I appreciate the note.
I will. I will put you in touch with Delaney and see what she can come up with.
I don't know how much that means to me. I don't want to say thank you because it's kind of hard to remember that on the phone.
No, I'm gonna put it in. And
put
on that
in
note,
an email, a short email.
I will. And on that note, I'm gonna hang up because I think what I ate is doing it again. Anyway,
go ahead. Get
thank
some
you.
Imodium.
Thank
and
you.
And have
Bye.
A good weekend. Bye.
Bye.